reading from the Yoga Sutras by Patanjali, chapter 1, verse 2. This is actually a very famous verse, one of the most famous verses. Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. Yoga meaning practice of yoga. Chitta, the mind. Vritta, fluctuations. Nirodha, restraint or control. So yoga is the restraint of the changing states of the mind. Okay, I always have to make this reminder that people that come on the Sangha, that you please mute your phone. That's star 6. Okay. I'll just say some prayers. Om Vijnana Marandasya Jnananjana Savakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Sayam Rupa Kadamayam Sadati Sapadantikam Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Vipashindhu Bhayevya Patitanam Bhavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasade Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ramo, Hare Ramo, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So greetings from Alachua. I'm at the beautiful house of Mahatma and Janaka. Many of you know them. And I basically just arrived, showered up, and ready to give the class. So just before I begin, I think I have to classify this class as a work in progress because, as I mentioned before, generally I deal with texts that are purely in my own tradition, and therefore I accept authoritatively. And I'm working with a subject that has a little bit of a different view on certain points. So it's a little bit of a challenge. And there's a lot of information, and I want to avoid, an overload of information. So I just really want to get at the essence of each text. And I also like questions from the class, which is nice. Some people did send me questions, and we're going to review this. And this particular verse, because basically Patanjali has packed into 4 words basically the whole subject matter. It may be this particular class, the longest of the commentaries, probably maybe do it in 2 or 3 classes, so we'll see. So we'll begin with the review. So yes, last week's class was Atta Yoganu Shashanam, but now we'll give further teachings on yoga. So I mentioned that this is yoga, they're sutras, and that generally each school of philosophical thought because generally it was an oral tradition, so they codify a vast body of knowledge into sutras. Sutras are short aphorisms. I have a definition which comes from the Chaitanya Charitamrita. A sutra is a compilation of aphorisms, short phrases, that express the essence of all knowledge in a minimum of words. So even this Yoga Sutra, it has 195 verses, but only 700 words. It's so much information. And all major Indian schools codify their teachings like this. And a sutra is usually limited to 6 words. And therefore, it's necessary for all sutras to have commentaries to unpack their meaning. So we have the commentary of Vyas, who's the main commentator. Not certain that that's the Vyas who's the editor, famous editor of the Vedas, but it's not certain that he's not either. And he's the main commentator, and all the other commentators, they follow him. So it's a sutra. So, so we went over that last year. Atta means now. Generally, the different sutras in the different schools begin with that word because that's so much meaning. Now indicates an urgency. It indicates a junction. You know, basically, you know, now that we've studied everything else, now here's the real thing. Or, now I'm going to give, you know, the real essence of the subject, etc. So there's some type of urgency. And also it's a junction. It's going to distinguish this exposition from other schools of thought. And you know, now you're going to be studying what? Atta yoga. You're going to be studying this particular subject. And it indicates a significance. So atta yoga, and this is the school of thought that we're going to be studying, is yoga. It indicates now this yoga will be discussed, and as we mentioned before, yoga has several types of meanings, but when you have it just yoga, not bhakti yoga, not karma yoga, when you have yoga, it indicates the process of fully concentrating the mind. And when you fully concentrate the mind, it's a psychosomatic process. There's a transformation that happens. And all types of school have this type of meditation. But yoga means when the mind is very, very concentrated and restrained. It's no longer distracted or wandering. So this type of kind of psychosomatic process is what's going to be discussed. And as we discussed last week, Anu means follows. It indicates that Patanjali is not presenting his own teachings, but systematizing something that existed before. And before Patanjali, most schools of Indian thought had appropriated this type of meditation or concentration as part of their practice. So Anushasana means teachings. It means he's following these further teachings. They've existed before, and now Patanjali is going to kind of codify it. So that's what we discussed in the last class. And now the next verse is describing what this yoga is. And I'm going to discuss that. It's very interesting. What exactly happens when you concentrate and restrain your thoughts? There's actually a transformation of the mind that happens, which is connected with liberation, which I'm going to explain why. Now, before we go on to that, I want to discuss one question that I received by email, because I would assume that most of the people, not all, who are on this Sangha because I started the Sangha with people of the Gaudiya Vaishnav tradition, which is basically Vedanta. It's one of the schools of Indian thought. And this is called Gaudiya Vedanta. It comes from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, etc., based on the Bhagavatam. So, actually, Sue Devi, she's probably listening, but she sent a question because I don't have the question before me, but the great commentator, famous, Baladeva Vibhushan in our tradition, he wrote a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. All people, Vedanta is a particular school of thought, and there's different traditions or ways of looking at it. And in the school of Vedanta, the person who wrote the commentary on the Vedanta in our tradition was Baladeva Vibhushana. And one of the chapters, he strongly refutes Patanjali's philosophy of yoga. Not all the points. He makes it clear that you can appropriate it, but there's certain things, and it's very, very heavy. So, naturally, this was a very good question to bring up. Not exactly why am I teaching this, but it brings up some of the issues that I was presenting. Now, but she, one thing is she, not she, but she sent me the text, the chapter, and I actually consulted with some people. It happens to be a particularly poor translation. That's one aspect of it. So the translation makes it heavier than it seems. But I just wanted to ask, there's some people here, you'll have to be patient. Sometimes someone else speaks, but I can speak. Mahamuni, are you there? Hello?
Hi, Marsh. Please accept my obeisance.
Yeah. Remember I shared that question with you?
Yeah.
Can you just...
I looked at that section again, and a good friend of mine, a devotee, very good friend of mine, who's a Sanskrit scholar, he did a paper on this where he translated that whole section, and he has the Sanskrit there too, so I got to check certain things. And the context of that part of the context of that part of Baladeva Vidyabhushana's commentary is where they're trying to, he's imagining an opponent who says something like this: let's interpret the Upanishads through the Yoga Sutra and through the Sankhya texts like that. And he argues, no, we should only accept those things which are harmonious with what we learn from Vedanta. So his condemnation is not of it, he's not completely condemning it. What he's saying is, it's not the overall authority by which we interpret our scriptures. The overall authority is the Vedanta Sutra and the Vedanta literature. And he actually says, and I'll quote, here's a quote, this is the translation of my godbrother Dvijamani. He says this, we have no animosity for those parts of these two systems of thought, that is the Sankhya and the Yoga, which are not contradicted by the Vedas. But that portion which is contradicted by the Vedas is to be refuted. And then he goes on and says that any portions of the Yoga Sutra here and there which are not contradicting the scriptures are accepted by us. Contradictory portions are rejected. That is obvious. So I feel like the kind of thing that you're proposing to do is take the best of the Yoga Sutra for our practice, and the rest of it, which may not agree with the Vedanta literature and with the Upanishads, we're not bound by that. And so I don't see that that's in opposition to what he's saying here. Is that okay, Marish? Is that the kind of thing
you were... Yeah, sounds good. I had to put it on a speakerphone because there were other people here, so I couldn't get that. But, yeah, I guess that's one of the things I found there were things valuable in it. And obviously there are differences. Even within Gaudiya Vaishnavism, you know, is Vaishnavism, Vallabhacharya, there's some difference. But there's somehow a way to reconcile it. Because even Prabhupada, he mentions, for example, Vallabha is one of the great acharyas, authorized. But in the same sense, there's some difference.
And
obviously, that's just going to be a fact that people have differences. But I think the main point which you were presenting, and I think, is that I found something very valuable in it, and I thought people could share it because it's the science. It's really the science of how the mind is transformed. And it can be applied to any practice. Okay, thank you.
May I just mention one other thing real quick, if I may?
Yeah.
One of the greatest commentators on the Yoga Sutra is a yogi named Vijnana Bhikshu, and he was a Vaishnava Vedantin, and he interprets the sutras according to Vaishnava Vedanta. And so I think that these texts have a lot of scope to kind of to take them in different ways according to one's tradition. And I think Patanjali was very good at allowing there to be room. You know, there's a lot of things he didn't specify. So in one sense, we're not bound by all the commentators on the Yoga Sutra. They may go in other directions, but Vijnana Bhikshu, among others, have given us ways as Vaishnava Vedantins to appropriate what we find meaningful. Anyway, that's just a couple things.
But he's one of the commentators that I have translated. And I think one of the points that comes very clear in the commentaries is that Patanjali, although he may have had a particular theological persuasion, he wasn't promoting it. Specifically for that reason is that he was describing something basically almost mechanically. That's just the science of the mind that can be applied to any process. So why put a particular theological bent in it and limit the scope of your readership, really? And it's not about a theological bent, basically, although, as you know, there is some type of theological conceptions, etc. But they're basic, actually, that there's Purusha, there's a soul, and there's Prakriti, and that somehow the Purusha or the soul is entangled or identifying with Prakriti. And therefore, one of the qualities of Prakriti or matter is vikara, is that it's always changing. And therefore, because of that identification, the soul, which is identifying with matter, experiences these changes which cause him duality, fear, and suffering, which is basic. One of the changes, for example, is death. It doesn't happen in the soul. Death happens. That transformation happens in matter, and the soul identifying with matter experiences that. So practically all the philosophical schools, or most of the philosophical schools, they deal with that basic point of liberation from that condition. Okay, now. I'm going to go on, and this is kind of a little bit new to me because I actually have to take copious notes. Usually I scribble a few things and I just speak, so we'll see how this works. So this is Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. So again, it's a sutra, so it's discussing yoga. And yoga is defined in various schools of thought. In different ways. Upanishads, the senses under control, Bhagavad Gita, evenness of mind, and Patanjali, restraint of thought. But basically it's referring to the same thing, that it's experiential liberation. It's a way of dealing with the mind so that you can actually transcend identification with it. And the basic idea is when the thoughts, the vrittis, are stopped, basically all these schools recognize that there'll be a profound transformation in the consciousness. And basically... I mean, you can look out. I'm just going to explain it in different ways, because yoga, chitta vritti, nirodha. So, basically, it's. I can explain it in one way, that sattva. Sattva, there's different. One thing that the commentators all say, that to really unpack the meaning of this, because it says chitta, chitta means the mind. To really unpack the meaning of these kind of sutras, you really have to have a little bit of background in Sankhya, which is a particular metaphysical understanding of how the world works. And I'm going to explain a little bit something about that, but because it's going to come up over and over again, it will gradually be very, very clear what we're talking about. But I'm going to have to start somewhere. So basically, prakriti means matter, primordial matter. And the basis of it is particular strands, which everything is composed of. Both the mind is also matter. And the sense objects are matter. It has these strands or qualities that mix together. And according to the mixture, then a particular quality of matter is produced. And it's described basically like this three primary qualities, primary colors. And their mixtures can make an unlimited amount of colors. So both subtle and gross things are by these different strands. They're basically three qualities. But one is sattva, or goodness. And what sattva really means, it means the pure nature of matter. When matter is really the pure nature of matter, becomes manifest when by the process of concentration, thoughts born of passion and ignorance, which impel the mind externally, are kind of suppressed. And the mind comes to its pure state, the pure nature. Basically, it comes to sattva, and that's what yoga is. And the quality of sattva is, one of the qualities is discriminating. So when you come to that state, when the mind is no longer distracted, you come to that point of pure goodness where and you're discriminating, and at that level you can really discriminate between the soul and matter. And that's actually, that's one way of understanding the problem. That actually these thoughts are suppressed by this degree of focus and concentration, evenness of mind, whatever you call it in different schools, they all know this fact. That when the mind becomes concentrated on one thing, and you subdue the vrittis or the fluctuations, it brings the nature of the mind, which is matter, to a pure state, and the symptom of that pure state is discriminating. And therefore you can distinguish between your pure self and what the self is thinking it is and causing it distress. And the other nature of this pure state of matter, which yoga brings you to that point, is that it's lucid and luminous, and therefore when you come to that state, it can reflect the soul in an undistorted way. But when the mind is being transformed by passion and ignorance, which we'll describe later, but basically lower modes, when it's transformed, then the reflection or understanding of who you are becomes distorted. Just like if you have a mirror with dust, then the image that's reflected in the mirror also looks that way, even though it's not. Or if the mirror has a concave shape, then the image that's reflected becomes distorted. So the basic concept of yoga is that by restraining thoughts, which are born of these lower modes of passion and ignorance, the mind becomes clean, the mind becomes lucid, it comes to its pure state of matter, and it can reflect the pure nature of the soul. And that's basically what yoga is. And in Krishna, in the Gaudiya Vedanta, when they describe the first benefit of kirtan is that it cleans the mind. Chaito, dharpana, marginam. Chaita means the chitta, the mind. Chaito, dharpana, marginam. Like a mirror, dharpana, it becomes cleansed. So the first nature is you begin to see yourself. You begin to understand the nature of your soul, which is a type of pure awareness. Of course, in different schools of philosophical thought, what the nature of that awareness is and what the relationship of that pure awareness is with the supreme awareness may differ. But the basic point is there, that the mind is a material thing, and when you concentrate and meditate, and therefore, it's like a strategy, because you're concentrating on one thing, it's kind of like, so that all the other things will be, and therefore, it also can be a mechanical process where you can meditate on anything. The basic thing is just that you put the mind on one thing, so all these other things will be suppressed. And then eventually at the higher states of particular types of yoga, then you even transcend the mind. It's kind of like a strategy. You can do one thing. But it's very, very powerful. We should realize that, even in our own practice, that there's not going to be any peacefulness, there's not going to be any clarity, there's not going to be any awareness of the soul unless we meditate. Now, we have a different idea in our type of practice of what the mantra is and the reciprocation, and it's a little bit different because we also feel that it just doesn't deal with the mind, but it directly touches the soul. But it also deals with the mind. And the mind is very, very malleable. So even in 1 or 2 hours of meditating, you can transform the mind tremendously. So anyway, this is why I'm finding it relevant, because in all spiritual practices, this is a fact. It's a transformation of the mind and how important it is. Because when you come to that state also of sattva, then the symptoms also are tranquility and peacefulness and so many other things. Another way of looking at yoga is, since all activities of the mind are products of prakriti or matter and are distinct from the soul, of course, again, there's some difference in this, but basically, at least according to Patanjali, all activities of the mind are products of matter, they're distinct from the soul. So when they're restrained, because they're an expression, they're an expression of material conception, basically, of selfishness, which is antithetical to the soul. So when they're actually restrained, and they're distinct from the soul, then the true self can be realized. So, as an autonomous entity distinct from the mind, as long as the activities of the mind are just uncontrolled, then you won't realize the soul, which is an autonomous entity and distinct from the mind. So therefore it has to be. So this is basically yoga in different ways. So they have different names. But that particular fact is practically accepted. There's minor differences in all processes of self-realization. One way or another, one has to control the mind. And when one does, by meditation, the mind comes to a more pure state, and it becomes discriminating, and it becomes reflective. And one begins to realize the pure nature of the self. Okay, I'm going to go on a little bit more, and then we'll have a few more questions. So I think, and the commentators do, they explain a little bit about Sankhya, the philosophical basis of yoga. And again, this will rise again and again, so if you hang on the class, you'll eventually understand it. So the first thing is there's two distinct categories of reality. At least two. In our tradition, well, even Patanjali is basically three. There's matter, and there's Purusha. Purusha means pure awareness of the soul. He also says there's a distinct soul, which he calls Ishvara, we call God. So basically, there's spirit, matter, and God. But basically, there's spirit and matter. And this is the identification of the soul with matter is the source of all problems. It's just like the example is given of a child who's given a pot of water. The child says to the mother, I want the moon, I want the moon. The child can't have the moon. I'm going to explain it again. I should just think this is a little bit from Gaudiya Vedanta, but this is basically how it's described. The child wants the moon. The child can't have the moon. He's not capable. We can shut it, or we're disturbing it. Okay. You want to come in and listen? Sure. She's just going to go sleep on your... Okay. So, the child wants the moon. The child came in second though. The child can't have the moon. So what the mother does to satisfy the child, the mother gives the child a pot of water. And the child thinks he has the moon. But then the pot is a little bit heavy and the child trips and then the water moves and then the child thinks the moon is moving. So the moon is not moving. The water is moving. So this is a basic analogy to describe what's happening to us. We somehow have identified ourselves as matter, and when matter transforms, we feel we're transformed. The problem is not that we're transforming. The problem is that we're misidentifying ourselves with the body, with the mind, with matter. And therefore, we're experiencing those transformations. And what this is. So this is the basic thing, this union. And the process of yoga, any spiritual process, is to somehow, I don't know what the word would be, to somehow liberate one from that misconception. And one way you can become liberated from that misconception is by this meditation. And therefore I described at the last class that this Astanga Yoga, which Pantakali mentions, indicating it's a progressive path, is really a process of developing deeper and deeper degrees of concentration. So if you begin with yam means moral restraints. And the first thing you have to do to begin to concentrate and neglect the vrittis of the thoughts, to begin a platform of meditation or concentration, the first thing you have to do is control how you deal with others. Because that's the grossest manifestation of the uncontrolled mind. And for example, one of the moral restraints is ahimsa or violence. If you don't control that, the exploitation of others, is no question of, yeah. So you start with that, and then when you are able to do that, then you're qualified for niyam, which is moral observances, celibacy, cleanliness, different things within you. And then you come to the platform of asana. Because if you want to concentrate, your consciousness can't be reflected in the body. Basically, you have to be unaware of the body. And the only way you can be unaware of the body is if the body is healthy. When the body is healthy, you're not aware of the body. So if you're sitting up and you're pained and you're aching and you're tired, you can't meditate. And then when you come to that point, then you can do pranayama. And pranayama means to, you know, the breath restraint, which he describes in a little bit of detail, then the concentration is greater. Then pratyahara, you can really neglect all mental impulses and withdraw defenses. That's the external part of yoga. Then yoga begins, really. Technically, yoga begins with dharana, dhyana, samadhi, deeper and deeper degrees of meditation. In Gaudiya Vedanta, and because I'm familiar with that, the seventh stage of meditation is called Dhruvana Smriti. It's described that your concentration is so powerful, and we meditate on God, that it's like oil flowing. You know, it's continuous, but you're still cognizant of something external. Even though the meditation is so deep, you're still cognizant of something external. But when you come to the platform of samadhi, you're not even cognizant. That's how deep your meditation is. So this is basically. I'm going to really finish here in 10 minutes and then answer questions. Because obviously I'm not going to finish everything. And I think the questions reveal the nature of it. Now I'll just give it, because it means yoga, chitta, vritti, nirodha. Yoga means the fluctuations of the chitta. So what is the chitta? So the chitta basically means the mind. But again, Sankhya has a little bit different, it is basically different categories of thoughts, and they kind of overlap. So I'm going to explain a basic understanding, but sometimes different people include different things. So basically, it's kind of like this. Buddhi means like judgment. First is the mind, manas. The whole thing is the mind, and when we say the mind, we mean chitta. But an aspect of thought is the mind, which organizes sensory input. So so much input comes from the senses, but there's an identification of it, and that's the mind. It kind of organizes it. This is what it is. And it ascribes feeling of attachment or aversion to them, based on past experience. Right? You have past experience, so you see that. You see something, you like it, you don't like it. You identify what it is, you like it or don't like it. That's basically the mind. Then, buddhi, or the intelligence, gives some judgment to it. It's not just good or, it's not what you like or not like, but according to knowledge or understanding, you make an ascertainment of what it is. That's why it's so important to fix up the buddhi. That's why with a child, the basic process of the development of a child is something like this, in a more classical sense, is their intelligence is not highly developed yet. So basically they learn obedience to parents, and the parents act as their intelligence. Otherwise, they will just, identify things and react, not necessarily for their benefit. So the parent is the authority, and what the parent does is generally trains up the intelligence. Right? So you give them values, knowledge, etc. And then, as when the intelligence is developed, then the parent gradually empowers the child to be obedient to its own intelligence rather than just the parents, because the intelligence now has been developed to give some understanding of things. And then there's ahankara, and ahankara is self-identity. It's very, very fascinating. So basically the sense object provides images as sense objects, and is received through the senses, It's sorted by the manas, what it is, how I feel about it, and then it's presented to the intellect to make some determination. Each of these, but it's so important, because I'm just going to, just if you understand that things come in and then you react to them. Right? According to how you react, creates a certain impression in the consciousness. There's also an understanding, too, that sometimes the citta, sometimes they say it's the buddhi, and sometimes the citta is memory. So it creates some impression in you, and you respond. Now that impression, that response, that it may not be a proper understanding, it may not be healthy. Just like someone has a bad experience when he's young with authority. So then, in the mind, he has a memory that authority is bad. But authority is not always bad. So then the child grows older, and then he comes into a practice where he has to surrender to the teacher, and he can't accept authority. And when he sees it, he responds. So obviously, the real process is we take sensory input. We may have some feelings towards them. But then, according to the intelligence, we have to make an ascertainment, an understanding, and then a will on how to react. And if one acts on the platform of intelligence that has been trained up in a proper body of knowledge, then whatever comes into the mind, the response to it will make a healthy impression in the mind. Just like you go through someone who's very mentally or healthy or has a strong intelligence, has been trained, he goes into circumstance and he has a very, something bad happens to them, right? But he can understand by the mind. He can understand what the law of karma is. He can see God behind it. So instead of reinforcing an impression of reality that's illusory and degrading, the same person, if he filters things to the consciousness through the intelligence that's trained up, the same experiment can make a good impression. So it's so important, actually, to understand these things. I have a lot to say about each one, and I think in the next class will specifically just discuss really what is buddhi, what is manas, and what is ahankara, and how they interact. Okay, are there any questions?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Kirtan.
Thank you very much. Maharaj, I don't have a question. I do have a comment, though. I'd like to thank both you and Mahamuni Prabhu regarding your earlier question, that clarification.
Okay. The people here, I want here. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, the clarification of why this is valuable in terms of understanding our position with the Yoga Sutras and how we deal with contradictions in other scriptures to our own understanding, or contradictions to the Vedanta Sutra, is valuable not only to our own practice, but for those of us who are engaging the yoga community, which is a growing number of devotees. It's extremely important that we have a clear understanding from our tradition of what everyone has heard thus far in the community that we're trying to explain Lord Chaitanya's philosophy of chanting the holy name to. And I'll just give you a quick example. For my Jiva Mukti teacher training, I have to write book reports, and one of the book reports I had to write was on the textbook of yoga psychology by Brahmananda Saraswati, who we all know as the Uptown Swami. And I didn't get more than a few pages into the introduction before I felt the need to critique rather than report, and immediately had to deal with his interpretation of Sankhya philosophy. And I feel validated in how I went about doing that by hearing what you're talking about, and in particular, what Mahamuni Prabhu contributed to this discussion. So I think there's actually a lot of value for us here in what you're doing, not just in our own practice, but in how we take, how we approach others who do actually have some philosophical background in yoga, but not from our tradition. It makes it easier for us to share effectively.
You can hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay. Anybody else ask a question?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. This is Gail.
Gail, Hare Krishna.
I have a few questions, but the main question is, it's not clear to me how it is that the mind, which is only matter, can be used to by us to see something spiritual, which is the soul. Even, you know, I know you say if we bring it to the mode of goodness, you know, in that way it becomes an undistorted mirror. But I just don't understand how we can use something material to see something spiritual.
Why not?
Because, just like they always say, you know, you cannot see Krishna with material vision, which, you know, you can't, it's not a mechanical process, you know.
Well,
it's
there's two types of vision, right? One vision is seeing a reflection, and one vision is actually seeing the thing. So even in the process of yoga, there's a certain level of samadhi where you're actually not actually seeing the soul. You know, it's a reflection. You're still, as the soul, viewing the image of the soul through a reflection. And then there's another image where the soul is experiencing itself. And that's, in the Yoga Sutras, that's considered a higher level of samadhi. It's a higher level of samadhi. I mean, you say, you don't understand, you don't understand. God sets the rules. This is how he's organized the world. When I'll explain it, you know, it takes a lot of study for me. Unfortunately, on the plane, I got to open up the computer before I came here. I've been traveling all day. We'll discuss this more. I mean, I don't think we can discuss everything in one thing, but it's somehow or other, it's kind of, you know what it's like? I mean, example that Professor Bryant gave is kind of like a movie film. It's kind of opaque, and light can come and luminous. So it's kind of like the soul is through it, and therefore it experiences the world. Because what happens is, according to Patanjali, Buddhi is very malleable, and whatever you experience makes an impression in it. So it's like a movie. Right now, there's consciousness in the body, right? And that's spiritual, so there is some connection. So it kind of shines through, like it shines through, and therefore can see the world. But this is the yoga philosophy. It makes impressions in the consciousness. You know, you see, and there's an impression of an elephant, and the Buddhi transforms into that shape. And then the Buddha is supposed to be the junction between the soul and matter, according to the yoga philosophy. So it kind of, the light of it shines through, and therefore for yourself. But I think that the answer to your question is this is the way, there's a connection. What is matter? Matter is God's energy. But it's difficult, therefore, the soul or the consciousness is very refined. It can only matter through the intelligence, which is more subtle. Mooney?
Sorry?
Have you come across this concept in your studies of the different darshans she's talking about? Want to add something?
My impression is that in yoga, when we say that you experience the soul through the mind, the way that you've described it, which I think is exactly what the text says, is you see through the mind when the mind gets out of the way. It's not even that the mind is so much of an instrument. It's the soul's own luminosity shining forth when the mind becomes pure enough that it doesn't get in the way anymore. So in one sense, it's not like the mind is a really important vehicle in all of this. It's that when the mind is sattvic, it just becomes clean enough that that some of the soul's radiance, so to speak, can shine through it. So the soul is experiencing. But it's experiencing, maybe, you could say, through the mind. But the mind doesn't have a really important causal role. Does that make sense, Marge? That's kind of my impression.
I think it's another aspect of this. Yeah, it does.
I mean, by the way, I think we often do see things that are material. We see Krishna through the deity, and the deity isn't material, but the deity is made of, at least it's on a superficial level, made of stone. And so the line between matter and spirit, I think that you said earlier that it's all God's energy. I think the line between matter and spirit is not as fixed as sometimes, maybe the yoga literature sometimes speaks in a radically dualistic way. But I liked how you made the point that it's Krishna's energy, which can be used in various ways. Anyway.
And that's actually the purpose of the buddhi or the mind. Okay, it's kind of... Gail, you have one more question, and then someone else.
Oh, okay. You're explaining that, if you have... The role of the intellect or the intelligence is to determine how we should respond to our stimuli, regardless of how the mind may feel about it. You know, we may like or dislike something, but the intelligence determines that how we should actually respond, not according to our likes or dislikes. And you can make you can make favorable impressions if you act according to your intelligence. But what do you do if maybe you, I think you would call it a weak intelligence, if by your intelligence you may understand the proper way to respond, you know, that you shouldn't respond according to your aversion, or to your attraction, but you should respond in this way, you know, according to your intelligence. But you find yourself unable to, even though you understand what you should do. And
right.
So for the purpose of developing more favorable impressions, you know, some scars in the mind, how do you do that if you find yourself, you know...
Well, what I have to say now, and just answer in a general way, is that, you know, there's Shastra. And Shastra is a whole science. It deals with each individual to strengthen their willpower and their intelligence. And there's many ways to do it. For example, there are very strong impulses that you can't transcend by the intelligence. So what you do is those impulses are regulated in Shastra. That's basically what you do with very powerful karma samskaras, but they're regulated. You can't transcend particular desires, so it's regulated. You can't transcend it. One gets married, you can't transcend it. You regulate it. And so there's a system on dealing with different things. There are vows. There's another thing, too. I forgot, it's called neuro-linguistic programming. People discuss that. It's also there in Krishna. You know, you have a samskara that impels you in a certain way. There's ways of putting other samskaras in, so that when that attraction comes out, another impression comes out. You put that in. You can put in good samskaras. So there's a whole samskara how to develop it, and obviously sometimes we're going to fail. But there's a progressive path, and that's the purpose of Shastra. It's a science. And I was speaking to Mahatma and Janava in terms of, lifestyle, And Mahatma was telling me one person who he gave 10 principles of how to be healthy. You know, drink juices, do this. One thing is throughout the TV. And he was also giving a quote from Paramahamsa Yogananda that environment is more powerful in controlling yourself than mere willpower alone.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a way to deal with the environment. There's so much knowledge and information, but we can't expect perfection. There's things that we can do to increase our willpower, and there's a science, and they're very, very powerful. It's adding some scars, it's changing the environment, it's taking vows. Vows is a very interesting thing. You say, I won't do this for today. I won't eat grains for today. Then every time you look at a piece of bread, because you've been trained for, let's say if someone's trained for young to be dharmic and honest, someone has honesty, then you make a vow. And therefore every time the impulse comes, the other samskara arises of, I must be truthful. If you don't have it, then you can build that. So there's many, many ways to deal this. Okay, I'm just going to ask people to say Hare Krishna because I've been traveling all day and it got a little bit late, but I would like a few people to just say hello. Anybody like to say hello today?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Rasagya. Thank you very much for the class.
It's always nice to hear from you, Rasagya.
Thank you.
I'm with Janava and Mahatma.
You can give them my humble obeisances also.
Thank you. Janava waves at Hare Krishna. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Anybody else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Bhav Maharaj, this is Baladev. Thank you.
Hey, you're back in the... okay, great. Thank you, Baladev. Nice to hear from you. Anybody
How else? Long will you be in the Washington area?
Okay. Hey, well, maybe we'll meet there. I'm going to come there in April. End of April. Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. This is Swani from Hartford.
This is who?
Swani from Hartford, Connecticut.
Oh, thank you. Swani.
Thank you for the class.
You were in India, right? You came with Jiva?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Come on. I'm also coming to Hartford. Chit is organizing a program at the end of March. Anybody else to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, it's Paramananda.
Paramananda, I'm in Alachua. Send me your phone number by email. I'll call you tomorrow.
Okay, great. Welcome to Florida, Maharaj.
Okay. It reminds me of that time we went to Alice with the tumbleweed, but anyway.
Yeah, it kind of does.
Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my humble obeisances.
Thank you, Avya.
And please remember me to Janava and offer both of my humble obeisances.
Okay, she's also just offered obeisances to you. Okay. Anybody else like to say hello? One more friendly soul?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Govardhan.
Over and on. Okay. We're going to do a program, I think, also at the end of March. I'll write you tomorrow and we'll finalize it. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I guess we'll end and Rati will send me the numbers of people. Thank you all. Okay. I think we're progressing in the class and we'll continue next week. Thank you. Panchakalpa Tarubhya Shakrapa Sindhu Vrayabhya Shapati Tanam Pavanibhya.